Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer Robert Margulef. But first, let's talk about Pandora buying Ticketfly. Ticketfly is an online ticket reseller, and they specialize in small to medium venues. Ticketmaster basically has all the arenas and all the major venues locked up, but Ticketfly pretty much does the same thing with smaller to medium venues. Now, Pandora, which you all know, is a radio-like streaming service. In other words, it's not interactive. You can't select the songs that you want to hear. You can select the genre, you can select the artist, but you can't select the songs. Pandora has never made money in the 10 years that it's been around, and it doesn't look like they're going to make any money in the future, which of course has shareholders besides themselves because it just doesn't look good on the horizon. Their costs are probably going to go up because the Copyright Royalty Board, which makes all the decisions on how much per stream they have to pay, is probably going to raise the rate for 2016 and beyond. So that means they're going to have to pay out even more money. So buying Ticketfly is actually a really good deal for them because for the first time, this is a chance to actually make some money. This is also a really good thing for artists. And the reason why is Pandora, a few months ago, rolled out something called Artist Marketing Platform. They call it AMP. And what this does, it allows an artist to actually send a message directly to someone that's listening to their music. So in other words, it's very easy to send a message saying, hey, I'm going to be in your town or near your town pretty soon. This is a great thing for artists, and it doesn't matter at what level you are, it's a great thing. The reason why is there's only 20% of all Americans go to concerts. And it turns out that they don't go, not because they don't like crowds, not because it's too much. They usually don't go because they're not aware that their favorite artist is actually playing in a town near them. With Pandora having 80 million active users, this is a chance for the artist to actually get the word out to them that they're going to be in their neighborhood pretty soon. So it's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for Pandora because it gives them a way to actually finally make a little bit of money. It's a win for the venues because if they can sell more tickets, there'll be more people coming through the doors. And it's a win, obviously, for artists because if they can get more people coming to their shows, it's more money that they'll make, it's more merch they'll sell. It's a good deal. So congratulations to Pandora because this is actually an acquisition that really makes a lot of sense. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's called 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is the quietest place on earth. Where do you think that is? Well, it's an anechoic chamber, and there's a lot of them scattered around in places that you're probably not familiar with. You kind of think an audio company, but the Navy has some for submarine work, and the Air Force has some. So there's a lot of government facilities, but the absolute most quiet one is at Microsoft. Yes, Microsoft at their audio lab has certifiably, by the Guinness World Book of Records, the quietest place on earth. It was measured at -20 dBA, which is basically the sound of air molecules knocking against one another. It's just dead quiet. So that brings me to a number of questions that I always get about room acoustics. And usually it's, how can I make my room quieter? How can I keep the sound in from getting out? How can I keep the sound outside from getting in? And really, this has to do with mass. Most recording studios are a room within a room. And let's face it, most of us that have home studios just can't do that. Our rooms won't allow us to do it. And it's an expensive proposition. There's no way around it. There's no cheap and easy way. There is something that you can do to make the current room that you have a whole lot better without spending a lot of money. And the first thing you have to do is work on the door, because that's usually the weakest link in the chain, your door. So if you're going to do this right, what you do is you get a solid core door. Most of us have hollow core doors, But they don't really do the job. You need a solid core door. And then the next secret is you put weather stripping around it. So basically, there's weather stripping around where it closes. Once you put that in, then you take a flashlight from outside the room and you shine it all around the edges of the door. And if you can see any light, then you haven't applied the weather stripping correctly and you have to go and adjust it. But sooner or later, what will happen is when you put this weather stripping on, you'll find that you'll have a very tight fitting door. And of course, if that happens, there's no sound leaking in and none leaking out. But you're not finished yet, because what you have to do is add a threshold to the bottom of the door. And this is really key. So just go to the store, buy a good threshold, put it on the bottom of the door. What you'll find is it will take a little bit of time and experimentation to really make that fit tight as well. But once you get the weather stripping on and the solid core door and the threshold, you'll find all of a sudden your room is going to be a lot quieter. But let's say you have windows in your room. Well, that's easily taken care of as well. All you need is a half-inch pane of plexiglass. Sometimes it's called plexiglass, sometimes it's called Lexan. Pretty much all the same. Different manufacturers call it something different, but it's plexiglass. So you get this half-inch pane, wide enough that it covers the entire window. And once again, we go and we put weather stripping around the edges of the window and mount the plexiglass on top of the weather stripping. All of a sudden, what's going to happen is your room is going to be a whole lot quieter. And if it still isn't, the next thing to do is then you put a pane of plexiglass on the inside of the window frame. What you're going to find is your room is suddenly going to be a whole lot quieter. It's not going to be perfect, because again, you need mass for that, but it's going to be more than acceptable for most of the things that you have to do. My guest today is producer Robert Margalef, who is really an innovator, as he was one of the very first synthesizer experts. This led him to a career in record production, starting with Stevie Wonder and some of his most beloved albums like Talking Book and Inner Visions, and later with the Isley Brothers, David Sanborn, and Devo, among many others. Bob is also one of the early proponents for surround sound for music and continues that passion today with Headphone Surround. I spoke with Bob via phone from his office in Hollywood. I'd like to go back to the beginning when you had Tonto's expanding headband. Tell me how that came about.
Well, the name came about long after our gathering. I had gone to Media Sound after sort of a journeyman's voyage through the audio business, working at Broadway recording studios. I had closed my film production studio where I was producing a film called Chow Manhattan with Edie Sedgwick and Jane Holzer, sort of from the refugees of the refugees from Andy's factory. And in the process, the only thing that I got out of the studio when I closed it was my synthesizer. It was a Moog 3, which I had intended to use to score the movie Chow Manhattan, which I ended up co-producing and working on for several years afterward. And I ended up by hook or by crook at Media Sound, where I met a guy named Malcolm Cecil. I had become, I had like I think a third or fourth synthesizer in the city at this point in New York. I had become the resident bad boy and synthesizer guy at a place called Media Sound on 57th Street. And it was there that I met Malcolm Cecil, who had signed on to be their night maintenance man, because in the days of analog recording, the minute you turn on any piece of analog gear, it starts breaking. So all the rooms had to be constantly maintained and operated carefully. And Malcolm, being a fine jazz musician and player, also became the night maintenance man at Media. We formed an instant bond and started working together with a synthesizer, because what I was doing was really whacked and strange. And I wasn't even sure if it was music, but Malcolm assured me it was and helped me a lot with a lot of judicious editing and so forth. And slowly we started pulling albums together with no particular thing in mind other than just to make music our own way. And Herbie Mann heard the record. He was there. The studio was generally closed at night because it was a union shop, and all the players there were all doing television commercials during the day, and I was the synthesizer guy for the studio, one of the few in the city. At any rate, one thing led to another, and I don't know what I was doing, but one crazy night I got home kind of loaded from a party and came up with the name Tonto's Expanding Headband. And it also was the acronym for the original Neo Tamboril Orchestra, which was a reach even in those days, but the name stuck. And we put out an album on Atlantic and got a big $5,000 advance from Herbie. Came out on Embryo Records, which was Herbie's vanity label at Atlantic. And one thing led to another, and then there came a very big review in the Rolling Stone about the music. And the next thing we know, Stevie Wonder was knocking on our door, and then my world changed forever.
Yeah, I want to get into
where it came from.
I want to get into Stevie in a second, but what possessed you to buy the synthesizer in the first place?
I was felt compelled. I cannot give you any intellectual reason why. I saw one of the Moog synthesizers bleeping and blooping at a place called the what was it called? It was a nightclub. It was sitting on the floor in the sound booth, somewhat fire damaged. It was called the club was called Cerebrum. And it was designed, one of John Storck's original designs.
Wow.
Although I never met John at that point, it was a fateful touch and reality because John went on to design Electric Lady for Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
And it was there that I actually met him, and I represent him to this day, WSBG here in Los Angeles. So that's where the genesis of the synthesizer came from. After I closed the studio and went belly up, so to speak, when the Chow Manhattan thing just became got out of hand, I started making music over at Media Sound, and then slowly, within 6 or 8 months or a year, we were working full-time with Stevie, and then the rest is history.
Well, how did you get in with Stevie? I mean, that seems like an unlikely combination.
Well, we got into it because Stevie heard our album, Zero Time, of Tonto's Expanding Headband, which had received this huge review in Rolling Stone. And one day, one of Malcolm's friends, a fellow bass player, brought Stevie to Media Sound, and here he was one summer afternoon or evening, toward the evening. Malcolm's apartment was next door to the studio because being the maintenance person, he had to be on call 24/7. We heard a knocking on the door, and the bell to the studio rang on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. I don't recollect exactly. And there he was standing there in a lime green jumpsuit with our album under his arm. And at that point, our world changed forever.
So when you went into the studio with Stevie, what was it like, considering, first of all, that you're working with someone that's blind, which that must have been different to begin with, and then he's coming from a different sensibility than you were. So how did you come?
The sensibility department, both Malcolm and I had considerable background musically in rhythm and blues, and especially with Malcolm with jazz, and me with an extensive background in classical music. So it really wasn't foreign to us. What was interesting was the melding of the technology with R&B. And that was what really fomented, I guess, the sea change in the music business, because we brought electronica to pop music. That was the first big major disruptor in pop music and R&B in general, was the use of the synthesizer in R&B. And we invented that. Before that, it was interesting stuff, some pop music. Peter Nero was doing some stuff. And, of course, the great classical thing with Wendy Carlos, the Switched on Bach, was happening around the same time as that. But that was moving in the classical direction. What we did is we brought it to a place where electronica became totally accessible to every man, not just the guy in the lab with the last coat and the pencil protector, you know,
yeah,
in his upper breast pocket. It was became a real musical instrument.
It changed the course of pop music. It really did. Oh, you're right. It changed everything, especially the way that he used it for bass instead of a bass, which nobody had done.
And we were creating some really great whacking bass sounds. And Malcolm is a bass player. He was the principal bass player in the BBC Radio Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
So it's not, any of this stuff is really not foreign to us. Also, the whole concept of the instrumentation was really based on the fact that it looked like a huge instrument, but it could only play one musical line at a time. It was a monophonic instrument. It was truly a synthesizer, not a glorified organ with the same sound on every note. We could put two or three separate notes, but there would be two or three different synthesizers playing on the same keyboard. It was the first and only instrument whereby... the performance of one person governed the performance of the other people on the instrument. It's one instrument played by several people instead of several people playing their own instruments together. One program affected the other programs. And when Steve and Malcolm and myself played the instrument, Malcolm and I were handling the programming. Malcolm a little bit of playing, me a little tiny bit of playing, but mostly programming. And we whipped up sounds that were monophonic. So when we did three different sounds on things, it was three different passes of the instrument. Or we would have the instrument play three sections of the instrument, each playing its own sound, all triggered from one keyboard, where we had a very interesting methodology of either using two keyboards stacked one on top of the other, or a few years down the road, we actually had a keyboard that was very interesting, interestingly designed, where it would help select the leading tone if we were playing in triads or, you know, chords. So you hear a synthesizer on Stevie's records. If you hear three of them playing, they were done separately or done two at a time, and each with their own unique sound. It's not like a string synthesizer where you play every note like an organ. Every note sounds the same.
Yeah.
Every note was different. Every sound was different. And that's what gives us its unique quality. But if you look at an R&B record or any pop music record, it's basically a quartet. Bass, drums, keyboard, and voice, or guitar and voice. Four instruments. It's the same thing with an orchestra. It's the high strings, medium strings, low strings. You look at an orchestra.
Yeah.
It's set up the same way. It's basically very simple, you know, Divisi of four, Divisi of six, Divisi of eight, but really they're not usually more than eight voices as a max, plus percussion, on any kind of musical recording. So it's not a complicated thing to think about.
I had no idea that you had layered those bass lines.
The bass lines are not layered. Well, they're layered in the fact that they have two or three synthesizers playing the same note, but all playing the same off the same keyboard.
Oh, I see.
Three different styles.
Yeah. I get it. Okay. How long did it take you to program something? This is back in the analog days, and you must have had really extensive notes, I guess.
No, not really. It was done basically by feel and by selection, artistic selection. Hey, Steve, here's the bass. So it's a little dull sound. Okay, is this a little brighter? Does this particular sound fit the song? No, see, this one sounds like a doorbell. Let's do something else. I mean, it was very impulsive, and it was very in the minute when we were programming. Programming was a part of it, and we would find sometimes we would program something, we'd have a great sound, and we'd try to improve it and go right out the other end of it and never to return. Because there was no memory. Our memory, we used to call it Armstrong automation at the console, because that's how we did it. We moved the faders with our hands and our arms. So that was Armstrong automation. And basically, we'd program stuff and we'd leave it up overnight sometimes and tweak it a little bit here and there. But basically, when we got the sound, that's when we used it. And then it went away and something else came up in its place.
Did you have any inkling of how groundbreaking those albums were when you were actually doing them?
No. You know something? It's like sex. You live in the minute. You don't have any inkling of what your kids are going to look like. You know?
Yeah.
I know it's a funny thing to say, but, you know, you just, when you live in the minute of the song, you live inside the song. I didn't take care of business. I didn't take care of my life. I didn't do anything. I became totally possessed and preoccupied with the music.
Yeah.
And making sure I was there every afternoon at 4:30. We finally had to leave media because they, you know, during the day they wanted to do Crazy Daisy Toilet Paper and Trans-Caribbean Airways and Ford Motor Cars and, you know, stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I was busy during the days, you know, with the guy from Gray Advertising saying to me in the from the back room, "Hey, kid, could you make that sound a little bit more like the tablecloth?" You know?
Yeah.
I got kind of, it was kind of tiring. And then, you know, I'd have a huge setup for Stevie down in Studio B with all the instruments in a circle so that he could move from one instrument to the next. And at media, they had a string date there the next morning at 10 o'clock, and everything had to be broken down. We wanted to have a place where we could work steadily and not be disturbed. And that turned out to be Electric Lady. It was a strange thing, but Jimmy had just passed and had just finished building Electric Lady with Eddie Kramer and John Storck. And the studio was really, Electric Lady was actually the first home studio. It was built by an artist for an artist's use. It was not a commercial enterprise like the Media Sound or, you know, any of the major players in New York. You know, those are studios that had the staff engineers with the white shirts and pencil protectors, and you came in for a certain number of hours and then you left. It was a service business. Electric Lady, on the other hand, was a personal studio. It was designed for Jimmy specifically for his personal use. There was no idea at all of, you know, utilizing it, except maybe in a few fringe cases, to use it as a commercial service enterprise. Well, here we are 50 years later and the studio is still chugging along.
Yeah.
But when I got there, I finally met John, who I had met very briefly at Cerebrum when I first heard the synthesizer, and we hit it off immediately. The cases for Tonto, for example, were designed by John.
Really?
And now the synthesizer's in, I guess, in Calgary at the museum, which I'm happy to see. And it's 50 years later. But that studio was very well suited for what we were doing with Stevie, because it was like putting our foot in a well-used shoe. It was already there. It was made for a singular artist. Stevie filled the bill and really filled the void for Jeffries and the whole staff down there, Jim Maron and all of those good folks down there, artistically driven people. And the studio had beautiful lighting, and to this day it's still functioning just to prove its longevity. But we worked there for about a year and a half or 2 years. Music of My Mind and the beginning of Inner Visions and filling this all found a place there. Our synthesizer could live there. We could keep the studio set up and come and go. We could come at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Stevie would arrive at 7. We didn't work to make an album. We worked to have a library of material, and Steve would work on different things at different times. I kept a notebook of where things were, which songs needed background vocals, which songs we needed to work on the bass sound, songs of theory Stevie needed to get copies of to work on lyrics, and so forth. It was a very open environment. And at Electric Ladyland, we hired, I would think, the first female second engineer in the history of the record business. Her name was Joan DiCola. And she could curse like a sailor, but she was very talented and together. And she had worked as the bookkeeper at Electric Ladyland. And she was drawn to the studio, and we were drawn to her. And we had this little group, and we'd leave the studio in August, in the steamy hot fog-filled mornings where we see the look up 8th Avenue or wherever it was, 7th Avenue, and see Columbus Circle at the end in the smog, and we would take a cab home at 7:30 in the morning. But we generally started 4 in the afternoon. Steve would come in between 7 and 8, and we would work through the night. It was timeless. There was no clocks. It was Stevie time. We worked holidays, New Year's, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And we had a very, very productive time there. Very few visitors, which was very good for us. We were not, in the end of our relationship with Stevie, we were inundated by what I call the drones, people who just there to hang out, fan the air in and out of the control room, and smoke cigarettes and make our lives unpleasant.
Yeah, yeah.
But those first few albums, we did everything. I mean, I even did the photography on Talking Book, the cover, the top photograph of Steve in the African garb and the inner sleeves, all that stuff. And
yeah, you did that, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I did Sarita's album. I did the cover for Minnie Riperton's album. All, you know, it was all like a family affair. We did everything in-house.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a great guy named Dennis who worked for us, and Malcolm's wife worked for us, and we took care of Stevie's tape library and administrating any musicians that came in and out, and we did everything. And lovingly. And with no questions asked.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, I knew then and I know now that he really was a messenger from a higher power. It even makes me emotional now to think about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. And the being unsighted, you asked that question. Strangely enough, when I was in prep school, I went to prep school, I was a not-so-wealthy little Jewish boy with a fairly disturbed personality, and ended up at a very small school up in the Berkshires called the Stockbridge School. And it was 80 of us, you know, co-educational before co-education and before, you know, completely mixed. You know, black and white and Indian and every race. And this was in 1958. But one of the people that was at the school was a woman named Tommy Keidlin. She was a physical fitness expert, and she was blind. And I learned how to take her skiing and to have put bells in my ski poles and how to work with unsighted people. So when it came to working with Stevie, it was it came as second nature to me. The thing that was good was to be able to teach him how to move around in the studio on his own, so he did not have to have someone take him to the bathroom or to get a coffee or to do things. He could move around on his own. And very strangely enough, it never became an issue.
Wow.
The thing about the synthesizer was it was a dizzying array of knobs and wires, and not something that someone unsighted could do, but he could play the shit out of the thing. So
yeah.
Malcolm and I took care of the knobs and the wires, contributed to the production, voiced our opinion, excuse me, and we had a very fantastic and wonderful, productive and open relationship, unmatched to this day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've made a lot of records, and I've gone down a lot of roads since then.
Well,
but it was a very enriching time. Then we came out here to California. Reason, Stevie wanted to move to California. He didn't want to live in Left Rock City anymore. So Motown had moved to L.A. from Detroit. Stevie had a new relationship with Motown, with his own new spanking new contract, courtesy of Johann Vigoda. And he came out here and we settled at first in a place called Crystal,
yeah.
But that was once yet another one studio complex, and James Taylor and all the folkies were over there, and having Stevie there full time did not really mesh very well. And I got a call from Gary Kellgren one afternoon, who was one of the creators of the record plant,
yeah,
which was down on 3rd Street at the time, a very creative place. And he invited me and Malcolm up to his house and said, look, you're the first engineers to work for an artist and not for a record company. You are representing Stevie's interests. He said, yeah, we are, and we're looking for a home. And he said, well, I will do something for you for a year at a time. Who would think of booking a recording studio for a year at a time?
Yeah, right. Wow.
So we went up to his big old house on Camino Palmero, now an apartment building there, but there was a big old Tudor house there, surrounded by pine trees. It was formerly the Canadian Embassy. It looked like some haunted Charles Adams drawing, right? And we went into the dining room there, and we sat across from a big table, and we made ourselves a deal on Stevie's behalf for studio time by the year, which included building a studio to our specifications, which included the surround control room, the speakers in the front and the back with Tom Hidley speakers, and because Quad was just coming in at the time, but also I loved having Quad in the control room because I could get Stevie to sit in the middle of the control room and have the music occupy the same space as him. The music became subjective, not objective, that it's in a frame in the front of you between two loudspeakers. Here's the picture of the band playing or whatever you think it is, but what it isn't, these records are made then and now serially on multi-channel recording equipment. But he was able to occupy the same space as the music. You have people often asking, why do those records sound so different? Well, part of the reason they sounded so different is that I was able to set up the monitoring. Gotham and I were able to set up the monitoring in such a way that the background vocals were in the back, the lead vocal was in the front, the Rhodes was in the back, the clarinet is on one side against the playing across from the guitar, and we didn't have to use the artifice of reverb and echo, which is the artificial creation of space. We had a ditch situational awareness in the early days of recording because we simply could not store it.
Yeah.
So we invented echo and reverb to substitute for it, to create the illusion of depth in space. But when you can actually move the sound in the space, in the room, although the records, Stevie's records, were mixed in stereo, as a matter of fact, my first surround mix was this song called Superstition, which I mixed in quad.
You're kidding. Amazing.
No, why would I kid you?
Amazing. Wow.
So you listen to the records, they all sound very dry because I don't want my music to sound far away.
Yeah.
I want the music to sound close. So we monitored in quad, but we mixed in stereo. The three of us at the board, Stevie, me, and Malcolm, Armstrong Automation. We had the most beautiful little API console you could ever want to have, and I could not make a mistake. If I farted in that control room in Studio B at the record plant, it was a hit. I could do no wrong in that room. Malcolm and I were just, it was a magical 5 years. We were touched on our foreheads by the hand of God. And I say that in an emotional way. It's just the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
And we couldn't do anything wrong in there. And for 5 years, we really, the three little planets crossed paths, and there was this bright light in the firmament that said 5 years, and then it was gone.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
So we made our deal in that dining room, and the strange thing about that deal was when we got up, Gary brought out the bottle of Cavassier toast, and we got up and we clinked our glasses together, and the minute we clinked the glasses together, there was an earthquake. Not a big one, but enough to say that I guess God heard us.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to put it. I really don't. But it was an experience that has never crossed my path again. And then we went down there and we just killed for 5 years. There was not only him, there was Dave Mason, there was the Isley Brothers, there was America, there was, I mean, an endlessly long list, Quincy.
Yeah,
you know,
I was going to say, you had a really long list of production credits then after that.
Oh, absolutely. Now I'm working with my new, what I think is going to be the next big disruptor since the synthesizer. And well, I think that's something called headphone surround.
You know, I think you're right. I want to go there. But let me ask you one more question here. Devo.
You can ask more than one question. You can ask two questions.
Devo.
Or three.
Let's go to Devo for a second, because
okay.
Again, that seems like it's you go with Stevie and the Isley Brothers and Billy Preston, and you're doing mostly R&B, and then you go to Devo, which at the time was, you know, totally opposite of that. And then you had the
not
biggest
really. You, but was it opposite Tom Thumb's expanding headband? No.
Well, it seems
I was making
like
electronica music. Well, it was not that different. If you really want to really take a look at the Freedom of Choice record, which is the only record that was really meaningful in terms of sales numbers for them, and its construct really is an R&B record. I recorded it the same way that I would have recorded Stevie. It's just that the content was different, yeah. But the approach was pretty much laissez-faire.
Uh-huh.
I gave them as much liberty as I could in the studio to the console to make sure that they got as much of a hands-on experience as possible. Producing doesn't mean taking control of everything. Producing means getting an artist to perform to the limits of his potential or her potential in the studio. And you do whatever you have to do to make that happen. And the Devos were another very interesting iteration. They were a very tight familial group, brothers. They had very interesting ideas electronically. I could help them realize it and understand what they were doing, being virtue of the fact that my background was electronica by this time. So I got them to sing great, I got them to play great, and I made a tremendous effort to make sure the recordings were as stellar as possible, which I did. And we had a great record. Is it what it really is? It's an R&B record. It prizes and approaches the music making from the same philosophy.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Okay. So now I understand. One of the questions I had for you was, how did you get into surround when it really started to happen, when it really started to pop in the early 90s? But you were in it way before then.
Yes. Musically, I was. We fooled around with a format for a minute called SQ or QS. There were two of them. And we had tried that. Here's a little strange story for you. A recent story. And that was one of the reasons why, during that period, the studios were building quad control rooms.
Yeah.
And the reason we could get away with building a quad control room is because Gary did Studio A and Studio B, and Studio C on 3rd Street is quad rooms with Tom Hidley. And we were somewhat involved in that, but Tom had some very interesting ideas, but they were quad, equidistant, 4 monitors, equidistant front and rear, and experimenting with live end, dead end, and all kinds of other wacky approaches to audio, compression ceilings, and all kinds of strange things. But we tried to, the end result was going to be quad on vinyl, and that's what QS and SQ were.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it did not work. First of all, people thought it was kind of crazy, and they could not get the kind of real separation that quad required on vinyl. It's just the crosstalk levels were way, way too high. If you had 15 dBs or 20 dBs of separation, it was a lot.
Yeah,
it just did not work, and they expected everyone to get special cartridges for their record players and all kinds of special hardware and so on. There was a run of stuff like that. A guy named Brad Miller came on the scene during that time and did a whole bunch of sound effects records that had, you know, trains and ping pong balls and stuff bouncing back and forth from left to right and all of that kind of stuff. A real preoccupation with massaging the medium was the order of the day. Stevie and I and Malcolm, as I say, experimented with the superstition. I had the horns in the back.
Really?
But could we get it into vinyl? No.
Yeah.
Not even close. Now, I'm working with a very interesting technology called HPS, Headphone Surround 12.1, which is 12 channels of audio, discrete channels of audio, 7.1 on the horizon, and 5 overhead, including the one in the center directly over your head, which we call the voice of God.
Hmm.
And do you know what I did last month ago?
What?
I took the HPS data stream and put it on the vinyl disc.
Really?
Really.
So it worked then?
Well, it works because it's digital.
Yeah.
although it's stored analogically on the disc, but it's a digital signal. So I'm going frontwards and backwards at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
People are loving vinyl. So think about people loving vinyl because HPS you cannot listen to on loudspeakers.
Yeah.
HPS is audio that unfolds in your head. It's 12 channels of audio in your head. If you listen to my website, robertmargulies.com, you will see some of the call-outs for the 12.1 there, and also call-outs for the VTS Headphone X system, which requires a decoder to play back, but the HPS requires nothing but a regular set of headphones. Like, you can go there right now and plug them in and listen to that site, and it really does explain exactly where I'm going with it.
Yeah,
but
I did.
Major step forward.
I went and I listened, and you're right. It definitely works, and it definitely works well. You know, one of the big problems with surround sound has been the fact that for most consumers, they would never have the speakers in the right places, so you'd never have,
much less being able to afford the speakers and the real estate to put them and the wiring.
Yeah, yeah,
and everything else. And kids are not interested in listening to their having a personal listening experience in their parents' home theater.
So one of the things that...
But now we can have a personal experience with any set of headphones, any cell phone, any website, anything. I can put HPS on my Facebook page. It does not require anything special. The HPS is baked into the audio itself. And once it's encoded, and once it's called rendered, it's there forever.
What I was going to say is the fact that's interesting in all this is that now we're getting into a virtual reality world with Oculus Rift and the Samsung version, and now so many more people are going to be experiencing audio on headphones because they're going to be part of this environment. So now is the perfect time.
And they're already experiencing. Everyone is already listening to music on headphones.
Yeah.
Before Oculus Rift, how many people do you know walk around with a set of earbuds? I can give you a total 12.1 surround on earbuds.
Yeah.
Why do I need even to be able to think about going into a home theater or some esoteric, highly expensive place to play back, or even have to buy a decoder from Dolby or DTS?
Yeah.
To play it back. When you go into a home theater, you want to listen to DTS, you go to the preamplifier and you select DTS playback, or you select Dolby playback.
Yeah.
This, you don't have to select anything. So it's there. It's already there for free. And my thing is to give this technology to put it in the hands of creatives. That's what I'm doing. I'm now working with my wonderful artist, Lexi Baker, and we have just finished our first pop record and HPS headphone surround, 12.1 headphone surround, where the music comes from over you. Who says that music has to be in front of you? Just because most of these people are preoccupied with picture and the dancing stick figures and everything?
Yeah.
Great music from the Jefferson Airplane and all the great acts, Dark Side of the Moon and all that other stuff, doesn't have anything to do with any kind of visual content whatsoever.
When
we've become enamored with having a visual context, but music can happen in space inside your head. It unfolds inside your head. Why do you need to have anything representational? It's nice, but not necessary. Great music, whether it's Bach, Brahms, or Beethoven, did not have a visual content. The orchestra looked exactly the same. You went to the concert hall, there they were sitting in front of you in a fanned out array with a guy waving his hands in the middle of the stage. It's always the same.
Bob, when you're mixing, are you mixing on headphones?
Absolutely. That's the final result. I'm mixing on very good ones.
Yeah.
And I love my headphones. I have Bowers and Wilkins. They're very, very good, about $400 a pair.
Yeah.
But I also should mix on a crapola set of earbuds right out of the box on an iPhone.
So you don't
you
have
know, a, iPhone earbuds.
So
it doesn't
you
make any difference.
You don't have a 12.1 speaker setup then, right?
No, don't need it. Why bother?
Yeah.
Well, now
that's
I will
a revelation.
Say this. I'll tell you where. Yeah. Well, I tell you where I bother. Okay. There has been, as you know, during the '80s and the '90s, especially through the '90s and to this day,
a certain flow, not very big flow, but a flow of 5.1 mixes, which was really when 5.1 music, when DTS really sort of, you know, pulled the string on doing a CD, a 44.1 CD of music only in surround. There was a huge amount of music mixed by Ed Cherney, by myself, by Grant Files, by Alan Parsons, Phil Ramone. There's a tons of people who are mixing in 5.1. There are still a certain number of people who are mixing in 5.1, especially people who are doing motion picture music like Hans Zimmer and people like that. But basically, the music was put out faster, because when the first Blu-rays came out, there was no music standard without a picture. You had to have a picture if you wanted to put music on a Blu-ray. So the DTS, who never really understood the music business as much as they wanted to, you know, I was busy mixing all kinds of things, you know, out of the libraries, out of the big libraries of things, you know, that were already hit records and stuff. So all of this 5.1 material is now residing in an SACD format, 5.1. Some of it great, some of it not so great. And now I can take those 5.1 SACD, the Super Audio CDs, and I can now render them into headphone surround. And I am now just beginning to approach record companies with a view towards taking those 5.1 libraries. I can't do them in 12.1 because the content is not there. But I can very simply remaster them for headphone surround. As a matter of fact, Elliot Mazur just sent me Frank Sinatra Live at the Sands in 5.1.
Wow.
Basically frontally oriented. But there is a lot of really interesting music there that the record companies who could not monetize it and spent millions of dollars on sitting there in the libraries, and they're worried about checking the little checkbox to do high-res audio,
yeah.
Which it isn't, really.
Yeah.
Why? Even if you check the box that says 2496, why? Because the original files are not high-resolution. They're analog.
Yeah,
that
right.
is not high-resolution. That's not 192.48 or 192.24-bit 192, which is high-resolution audio. Okay.
Yeah.
So there was a space there when digital recordings are not terrific, but a lot of that stuff that Tono's listening, they're just ripping off the CDs. That's not high resolution anything. That's 44.1.
Yeah, it's
you know, and yeah. analog tape, not that interesting.
Yeah.
But what I can, you know, and they say, oh, high resolution, you can have a wonderful listening experience. You ask me if a person on a skateboard with earbuds really gives a shit about that.
Yeah.
The answer is no. But if we can deliver a wholly different experience, an experience where we bring spatial awareness back to music, then we've done something very, very major and very different and very interesting. Because we have brought back one of the senses that we had to leave behind when we invented the record. And that is spatial awareness, where a sound is coming from. How does your brain know where a sound is coming from? How is that decision made in your head? Right?
Yeah.
So if we can control the crosstalk, in other words, if you're listening to me in a room and I'm talking to you from in front of you, both your ears listen to me at the same, a little bit different spacing because your head is in between it, right?
Yeah.
But the two ears are listening to the same signal, right?
Uh-huh.
Top end, delay time, all of those things. But if I walk off to your right and keep talking, your brain says, oh, that sound is coming to me from my right side. Why is that?
Yeah.
Well, it's because I'm having more top end in my right ear than I am in my left. And my left ear is getting the signal a few nanoseconds later than in my right ear. And my brain says, aha, that sound is coming from the right part of my environment. So
yeah.
If we can control the crosstalk, and I do that by putting on headphones, because then there is no crosstalk. If we can control the crosstalk, then we can control and figure out with the judicious use of filtering and delays and so on and so forth, exactly what it takes to emulate the space in your brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, everybody's brain is a little bit different. They don't hear things exactly the same way.
but it's close enough for Uberman, for every man,
yeah.
to be able to have that ability, because space is an important part of music. Situational awareness is an important part of music. That's why we invented reverb and decay.
Yeah.
Reverb and doubling and this sound and that stuff. But now with pop music and synthesizers, which I was partially responsible for, who says the music has to come between in the picture frame in front of you? Nobody.
Yeah.
If you want it in a motion picture, then the music has to support the picture. But if you're looking at purely a musical experience, a composer can like to have music over his head or behind you.
Yeah.
I have sounds coming from behind me.
Yeah, it's very effective, okay? too. Very effective.
Yeah, but what has it done? We have finally returned to 100 years of lack of situational awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're able now to use that as a creative tool. It's not a gimmick. It's the way we work. Our brains are reptilian when we go back, when we were just pulling ourselves out of the slime and becoming human beings. Our hearing is really designed, like our eyes, for specific things. Why are our eyes on the front of our head, for example, and not on the sides like a bird? Well, because we're prey animals. We need to create 3D vision in order to judge the distance between our own mouths and our next meal. Basically, we can decide how to snatch it. That's why eagles have front facing. Owls have front facing. But animals that have side facing are prey animals. They need to have 180 degrees. They don't really need to see stereo. But what they need to do is have a wide angle of view so they can see if there's a threat. So if we hear a sound that's coming from behind us, unconsciously in our minds, our little mind says, uh-oh, that could be dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can't see it. Right? What is it? Is it a threat?
Well, this is, as you say, it's very cool. It's a cutting edge, and I urge everybody to go have a listen. Go to your website, and I'll include links so everybody can go there as well. I have one last question for you here. What's the best piece of business advice?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the last question. I'm happy to be of service.
Thank you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've learned through your career or that somebody imparted to you?
Stay the course and believe in yourself and believe what you have to offer the world, and go out and do not use as many interlocutors as we used to have to use because of the girth and the size of the equipment and everything else. Because now, the new folk instrument to me is a laptop. That's as much a folk instrument to me as Fender Rhodes was in 1978.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. People write on it. People use it. But now the real trick is to get the music to the people who live it. And basically back in the 70s when there was Rodney Bigenheimer and you were a boy and you're a slip of a lad, we used to play the clubs. The bands would go to Devo, would go to the Starwood and play out, and lo and behold, we would get some local radio play, and the record companies would come around and say, oh, these guys have local radio play, and they're out there, and they're doing stuff, and they have their own theme going. All we have to do is sign on. We don't have to really do too much development. We can put them in the studio and have a reasonable expectation that they're going to come out with some music that we can sell. Well, we still have to have a reasonable expectation that you have to make music that you can sell. But the gatekeepers are gone, and as a matter of fact, the gates are gone. Everybody's out of the bleachers and on the field. And everybody has music to offer to sell. Most of it's rubbish. 90% of it's rubbish and disposable, like a lot of the house music and stuff like that, which is good, basically use it once and throw it away. It's totally like toilet paper or tissue paper. You use it once and throw it away.
Yeah, there's no longevity to it, right?
No longevity. It's not intended to have longevity. It's only intended to make you bounce your butt for 3.5 or 4 or 5 minutes. And I mean, people playing records, that's not to me. I mean, these guys making $50,000, $60,000 a night to play other people's music,
Yeah.
that to me is not really the essence of true art in a lot of ways. It's massaging the medium and using the medium as a message. Marshall McLuhan said it very clearly. The medium is the message.
Yeah.
Well, now we are getting a lot of that. The medium is the message. But for the true songwriter, for the true creative, who really is a composer, whether it's pop or classical music or anything else, we now can compose in a 360-degree bubble, a dome around you, and use perspective, situational awareness, as well as pitch decay, melody, songwriting, lyrics. All of those things still mean something. But you have to get out and you have to do it for yourself first. You're, no one's going to jump on your bandwagon unless they feel reassured that they'll be able to take something away from it in terms of a financial reward. Nobody wants to work for nothing. And that's the problem we're having in the music business now because of the file sharing.
Yeah.
Why should musicians even begin to think about being fucked in the butt every time their record plays and they get like half a cent of royalty and stuff like that? It's all going to stop because musicians are going to finally get to a place where we're going to say we're not going to deliver any more music for a while until people start to rethink the business model. Because it stopped being the music business and became the file sharing business. And the file sharing business does not have a soul. It's just a business to make basic maximum profits for the shareholders. It has nothing to do with music or art or feeling or reflecting our time. Yeah, it reflects our time and the impersonality of it. But there is still the core of real music. And those are the things that we need to pay attention to. And if you have good music and you have something that really touches people's hearts and minds, you will have success. You have a means of being your own record company. Like I was saying, back in the 60s and 70s, you'd make your record, you'd go down to the local thing and cut an acetate at the local studio, and the guy would go in the back room and cut you an acetate, and you'd go and you'd make a bunch of 45s, and you'd go to the swap meet on Saturday, and you'd open the trunk of your car, or you'd have a table at the back of your gig and you would be selling your records and your merchandise. It hasn't changed much except it's become very commercial and very big business. But basically every band does it, and that really hasn't changed. And that, to me, is where the saving grace of music is, because when people have become a commercial artist, in other words, a songwriter, they now can control the entire chain. They do not have to put their futures in the hands of interlocutors who use it as a means of leveraging other things. Oh, you play this act, I'll give you this act. Oh, you want Elton to play this thing, give me this opening act for his shows on the East Coast or this, that. There's none of that stuff going on. Now, if you have it, you'll do it one way or another. But part of being a musician and doing it is being the bard and the storyteller. And that means that you have to get out and bring the music to the people yourself. We have the means to do it. It's called iTunes. We have Tidal. We have all of these places. It's not your website. Bobby Osinski's website is just as big as Robert Margulis' website or Warner Brothers' website. It still fills the same space on the screen. It's not bigger. It's not smaller. It's not more imposing or less imposing. But what do you have that people want to see and hear?
It's good advice.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you in the next couple of days the first HPS 12.1 Lexi Baker single called Say It Like You Mean It, and another one which I'm just finishing up now called Stardust, which are on headphone surround, HPS 12.1. And it is music designed and conceived the idea that there is a no front of the room to speak of. It is the, you occupy the same space as the music. You live inside the song. And that, I think, is the next great, great disruptor in music, and that's what I'm into. I'm very, 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 very happy to be involved in it because I think this is my swan song. After all, I'm 75 years old. How much more time do you think I'm going to be here on the planet doing this stuff? You know?
Well, might be longer than you think. I hope it is.
I hope it is too, but yeah. You can never tell,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right.
So
right.
I'm just listening to my messenger,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Just like I thought Stevie was a messenger from a higher power. Look what he did.
Yeah.
If he didn't have those songs and have his approach and his incredible musicality, none of it would have made any difference.
Yeah, right.
I just provided the container, you know. He was the talent.
You can find out more about Bob and Headphone Surrounds at robertmargouleff.com. That's Robert Margouleff, MARGOULEFF. That's all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyointercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put this show together. Thank you very kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyointercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.